It's Wednesday, August 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, U.S. airstrikes hit Islamic State positions in Libya. The Prime Minister of Singapore is in Washington, talking trade and history.
How do we fit the one major world language that has no alphabet and more than 70,000 characters onto this new technology?
A unique collection of Chinese typewriters is about to go on tour. Also ahead, it's time for the Olympics, and there's a new theme song. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. The United States has conducted precision airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Libya at the request of the unity government, known as the Government of National Accord. The strikes were carried out around the coastal city of Sirte, which for more than a year has been an IS stronghold and is now the objective of an offensive by pro-GNA forces. Peter Cook is a Pentagon spokesman.
GNA-aligned forces have had success in recapturing territory from ISIL, and additional U.S. strikes will continue to target ISIL in Sirte and enable the GNA to make a decisive strategic advance. Prime Minister al-Sarraj, the head of the GNA, announced that he had specifically requested these strikes as part of the GNA's campaign to defeat ISIL in Libya. As we've said for some time, the United States supports the GNA. We would be prepared to carefully consider any request for military assistance. The requests will be carefully coordinated. They are specific requests from the GNA, but they're precision targets which they've asked for our assistance with and which they have had more trouble. These are targets, for example, I can detail today, one of the targets struck today was a tank. It is that kind of precision target that we'll be targeting that the GNA at this point felt like that would be a helpful support for their efforts.
University of San Francisco regional analyst Stephen Zunes was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty how the GNA, a product of UN mediation, can act without having been elected by the Libyan people.
Exactly. It is basically an effort by the international community to put together a coalition of what they hope to be responsible forces who can bring the country forward, but they have been unable to provide a steady base of support. Now, one can be argued, of course, that based on the one election that the Libyans were able to have following the overthrow of the longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi, that the majority of Libyans did vote for a moderate secular coalition. But these are not the people who have tended to have the guns and have not been the people who have tended to end up controlling much of the country.
Well, this unity government is using Western-placed rebels from Misrata to engage in this offensive. Does the U.S. campaign give us the sense that the offensive to push IS out of Sirte has stalled?
The fact that they did call in foreign air support is indicative that they are not strong enough to do it on their own. And that may mean that, especially given the warning that this could be a sustained operation, means that the internationally recognized government really does not have the kind of organization or kind of support to control the country on its own, even against an extremist group like ISIS that presumably has very little popular backing among Libyans themselves.
This does represent, though, a widening of the air war against Islamic State in the Middle East.
Yes, it does, and it raises the question about how long is this going to go on? Are we faced with years and years of this low-intensity conflict where the United States is involved in several countries attacking strongholds of ISIS and other extremist groups? Even if one can make the case that such operations are militarily necessary and are in the national security interests of the United States and other countries, it is, frankly, a rather disturbing prospect.
A White House spokesman said President Obama has made it clear he will deny any safe haven to groups like Islamic State or other terrorists who wish to do us harm. U.S. politics are always prominent on social media, and so with that, we check in with VOA's Andrew Palcheski about a couple of trending Twitter hashtags that are swirling around the Donald Trump camp, including a controversy over Mr. Trump and veterans.
Absolutely. This is something that started on social media and has kind of lived and evolved on social media. It started, of course, with Khazir Khan speaking at the Democratic National Convention last week about his son who was killed in Iraq, asking Donald Trump if he had read the Constitution. Well, amid this controversy over veterans and their families, Donald Trump today was in Virginia, not too far from our headquarters here in Washington, D.C., and a veteran actually presented him with his Purple Heart, and that's an award that's received in the United States when you're wounded or killed in action. So this veteran was wounded. He gave Donald Trump this Purple Heart. So that's been a trending topic on social media. However, there's some question about if it's the actual award or a copy of that award. The veteran later said that it wasn't the actual one. It was a replica. There's a lot of back and forth as this issue continues over how Donald Trump is reacting to veterans and their families.
Any reaction from the Clinton camp on Trump's activities?
Not to the Purple Heart being awarded to Donald Trump, although they have been using social media relentlessly ever since that speech from Khazir Khan on Thursday night to try to discredit Donald Trump, to try to attack him and say that he is not in support of veterans' families. For his part, Donald Trump has been trying to use his Twitter account, his Twitter following, to rebuff those statements. So it is a bit of a social media back and forth. Another social media back and forth that we have today is hashtag Trump Olympics. I'm not sure, you know, sometimes these hashtags just start trending and I'm not sure exactly where they come from, but they're just these jokes and things. And this is the case with the hashtag Trump Olympics. You have everything from pole faulting to small handball. Of course, Donald Trump has talked about his opponent's hand size in the past. And synchronized speaking with a picture of Melania Trump and Michelle Obama. Of course, Melania's plagiarism controversy at the convention. But as often is the case with these jokes, you have the other side starting to jump in. So you have some things about parallel pole vaulting and having Hillary Clinton behind bars and those kind of things. So it's being played on both sides, but just another joke in this political season that we're seeing as these things pop up on social media and kind of not just thrive on social media, but really explode.
Andrew Palcheski following it on social media for us. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you may follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL and myself at VOA Stevenson. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Among the top stories in Asia that are trending at this hour, Beijing warns of security threats in the South China Sea. Pakistan leans toward curbing activities of group linked to Gulen. Rains, wind from Typhoon Nida shut down Hong Kong. Afghan mother who lost multiple sons to Islamic State fears for remaining sons. Ailing politician cancels 10,000 bike campaign parade in India. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. President Obama and Singapore's Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong have restated their commitment to passing the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership. The two leaders on Tuesday discussed the TPP 12-nation trade pact that is currently stalled in Congress. Mr. Lee said he understands TPP is politically unpopular in this U.S. election year, but also said its ratification will be a litmus test of America's credibility and seriousness of purpose. Anki Panda, an associate editor of the Asia-Pacific current affairs publication The Diplomat, says the TPP stands to change the economic fabric of the region and is the economic leg of the U.S. pivot to Asia.
TPP stands to integrate 12 economies into a highly complex, probably the most complex trade arrangement between countries of that nature ever to exist. And if it does come into effect, it'll have important ramifications not only for Singapore, but also for other signatories, including states like Vietnam and Japan. Notably, the TPP excludes China, so there's also a geopolitical slant to the agreement, but it's something that the Obama administration has clearly been prioritizing. The TPP can't enter into force without the ratification of the United States. Specifically, the agreement requires the ratification of the trade pact by countries comprising 85% of GDP of the 12 signatories, which means that actually Japan and the United States are the two countries that absolutely have to ratify the agreement in order for it to come into force. the other 10 members are less important. For the United States, failing to ratify the TPP would essentially reflect very poorly on the persistence of any sort of grand strategic approach to Asia. The Biden administration has gambled quite a bit on the rebalance and the pivot to Asia, and if that were to fail to continue, that would severely impact how U.S. allies and partners view the United States in the Asia Pacific. The United States would essentially be seen as an unreliable negotiating partner, and more importantly, would not be seen as a primary Pacific power. I have been surprised by how inflamed the tensions over trade have gotten over the electoral cycle. Currently, both the Republican and the Democratic nominee, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, have both spoken out against the agreement. Obviously, Mr. Trump is more strongly in opposition to the agreement. Many people say that Hillary Clinton is likely to reverse or soften her stance on the TPP, seeing as she was Secretary of State at the beginning of the pivot and is likely to reverse course, recognizing the geopolitical importance of the TPP. One of the issues in the United States has been that free trade is perceived as not uniformly creating winners, but also creating losers. And the U.S. government has been criticized for perhaps not doing as much as it could to take care of some of those losers, which has made it a hot-button issue politically in this country.
Ankit Panda, an associate editor of the Asia-Pacific Current Affairs publication, The Diplomat. Mr. Lee is joining President Obama at a state dinner in the White House this evening. It's the first for a Singaporean leader since 1985, as they celebrate the 50th anniversary of U.S. diplomatic relations with Singapore. For more than two centuries, China and Japan have been working to keep up with Western innovations in information technology, most prominently the typewriter. That history of evolution would have been lost to time if it were not for a unique collection of a Stanford University associate professor. The Chinese Typewriter Museum is about to travel the world, and we hear more from its curator, Tom Mullaney.
It's Morse and Remington and Underwood and Apple rolled into one.
There's so much to this.
China is an IT giant. It's one of the largest new media and computing markets in the world. China just didn't become this overnight, so there has to be a story to this. And it's like, well, yes, there is a story to this, but you know, we've now got to do some spade work and go dig it up because we've been systematically ignoring it for so long now.
Tell me a little bit about the Chinese Typewriter Museum.
In contrast to the history of Western information technology, there are really no museums or archives dedicated to this subject. There's no one place that a scholar can go to look through the archives of this history. So just by virtue of necessity, I basically had to build an archive myself over the past 10 years. And so this, you know, in a concrete sense, this meant purchasing Chinese telegraph code books and photographs and patent diagrams and ephemera, and also Chinese typewriters, Japanese typewriters, word processors, and computers, many of which were actually donated to me. And about three, four years ago, I kind of almost like woke up from a dream and realized that outside of, I don't know, the Smithsonian or maybe the National Library of China or the National Diet Library, that I had amassed one of the world's largest collections, if not the largest coherent collection on this subject.
We, of course, in the West are used to an alphabet. In China, that's not the case. In fact, there are 70,000 characters they were choosing from in trying to come up with a typewriter. This must have been a phenomenal engineering feat.
It was. Chinese is the one major world script that does not have an alphabet or a syllabary whatsoever. And so from the 19th century onward, the urgent question that was facing Chinese modernizers and politicians and intellectuals and everyday individuals was, how can China participate and take part in these game-changing communications technologies like telegraphy and typewriting and moving forward? Because every one of those technologies was, by accident of history, invented in the alphabetic world and at no fault of their own by inventors who, quite understandably, were thinking with the alphabet in mind. So every time one of these new technologies began to emerge, the question was the same. How do we fit the one major world language that has no alphabet and more than 70,000 characters onto this new technology? the engineers who had to think about these puzzles didn't have to just think outside the box, to use that cliche. They had to forget the box even existed. They had to reimagine not only what the Chinese language would be like moving into the future, but also what the typewriter would be or what information technology would be, because everything was going to have to change in order for the Chinese language to participate in these information technologies. They couldn't just make this transition in any simplistic, straightforward way. So, yeah, they're absolutely brilliant engineers and linguists in this story.
Tom, thank you so much for spending time with me and telling me so much more about this.
It's my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
The Chinese typewriter exhibit is at Stanford currently, and then it moves on to San Francisco International Airport. And after making several stops around the world, Tom Mullaney says his goal is to transfer the entire collection to an institution to make it open and available to researchers and the public. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palkov.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. A prominent pop star's latest single will be adapted for the televised American coverage of the upcoming Rio Olympics. Yes, the opening ceremonies are nearly upon us. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to tell us about it.
Okay, Larry. Well, I guess the subject today is Katy Perry. What's up with her?
Well, thank you, Sarah. Yes, indeed. Katy, who has sold over 100 million records around the world, was Billboard Magazine's Woman of the Year in 2012. And, of course, we know her from the Super Bowl halftime show a couple of years back. And she's back now with a brand new single. And she said this is a song that's been kind of in her head for a while now, but she thinks now is the right time because it's a song about unity. It's a song about coming together. She said the world needs a song like this. It's called Rise. NBC Television has adapted the song as the theme to the Rio Olympics coverage they're going to be starting this weekend. Hmm. So Katy's new song is out now. It debuted at number one in Australia, debuted at number 11 in the United States. It's moving up the charts. And the video's coming out this week. It comes out Thursday for the song. And it's kind of a video that features different elements. She's got a pink parachute, and she's outdoors, and there's wind in her face, and there's a lot going on in the video. But she said, now's the time for this song, and everybody needs a song like this. And apparently she's right, because a lot of people seem to be liking the song.
Well, Katy Perry was quite visible at the recent Democratic National Convention.
Yes, she did give a speech on behalf of Hillary Clinton, and she and her boyfriend, Orlando Bloom, who's an actor, they kind of worked on the speech together. She's been an advocate for a lot of things, gun control and things that, former Secretary of State Senator Clinton seems to stand for these days. And so that's kind of, where she's at, and she wanted to put her stamp of approval with a lot of different celebrities who came out to endorse Hillary Clinton for the presidential nomination, which she received for the Democratic Party. So, but that's for you to cover in the newsroom. That's not for me in the music world to worry about. But Katy is definitely out there. She's lending her face to a lot of different things, including CoverGirl Cosmetics. She was one of the most followed celebrities on social media recently. And as I mentioned, she had a much publicized divorce with Russell Brand a couple of years ago. And now she's in a much publicized relationship with actor Orlando Bloom. And her fans are known as Katie Cats.
Ah.
They support her around the world. So we suspect a new album will be coming out soon. She said she didn't want to wait until the album came out to release the song Rise because she mentioned, as I said earlier, now's the time for a song like this, which is a good tie-in with the Olympics and the message the Olympics are presenting to the world as well. So the song is called Rise.
All right. Thanks, Larry London. Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us anytime you like at voanews.com. We're also online on Facebook at VOA Now, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, and our engineer is Dan Crafton. I'm Jim Stevenson. We are all in Washington, and we thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. Come back when you can. We're on the air each and every day, all week. Have a great day ahead. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than $2 billion in new money was raised for the people of Iraq at a recent donors conference jointly hosted by Canada, Germany, Japan, Kuwait, the Netherlands, and the United States. The funds will go towards alleviating the suffering, deprivation, and devastation inflicted on the Iraqi people by ISIL. In order to address the grave conditions faced by those displaced in Iraq, the international community has committed to providing desperately needed humanitarian aid, including food, water, and shelter, as well as stabilization programming to help create the conditions that permit displaced families to return home to liberated areas in safety and in dignity. The conference garnered more than $590 million for humanitarian assistance in support of Iraq through bilateral and multilateral channels. This humanitarian assistance will support the needs identified in the 2016 UN Humanitarian Response Plan, in addition to other organizations providing aid in Iraq. Through these organizations, the international community has provided resources for assistance to every governorate in Iraq, helping people who need it most. Donors also pledged more than $350 million to support stabilization efforts. Pledges for the United Nations Development Program's funding facility for immediate stabilization totaled $125 million, a significant advance towards meeting the $180 million the UN requires in 2017 to support rapid restoration of power, water, and other essential services in areas liberated from ISIL control. Over $80 million in new pledges for demining efforts in Iraq were secured. This will provide approximately three-quarters of the total amount of funding the United Nations estimates is required for 1 year of demining activities in Iraq. The United States was the first major donor at $50 million to pledge funding to the new United Nations Development Program funding facility for expanded stabilization. This facility will support activities that will restore critical public services and create jobs in Nineveh, Salah al-Din, Diyala, and Anbar provinces. The United Nations estimates that teaching colleges, hospitals, and universities eligible for these funds will be able to employ an estimated 17,000 to 20,000 people in each of the areas previously devastated by ISIL. The United States believes long-term stability in Iraq can only be achieved by ensuring that its people are able to return to their homes safely, with access to basic services, health care and education, and hope for economic prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.